You're listening to The Leonard LoPage Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
An editorial in today's New York Times criticizes the, quote, unanimous decision by Senate Republicans on Tuesday to filibuster and kill President Obama's jobs bill. It describes that decision as, quote, a breathtaking act of economic vandalism because with 14 million people out of work, wages falling, poverty rising, and the possibility of a second recession, there's an obvious need for some bold action. Joining me now for an informed look at the situation, both in the United States and around the world, are Michael Spence, a Nobel Prize winner in economic sciences. His latest book is called The Next Convergence, The Future of Economic Growth in a Multi-Speed World. Also with us is Matthew Bishop, U.S. business editor for The Economist, which recently published its own jobs report. I'm very pleased to welcome both of them to our show today. Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning, Len.
If it were passed, do you think the President Obama's jobs bill would create the 1.3 to 1.4 million jobs in 2012 that the White House has predicted? Begin with you, Michael.
I think there's a chance that it would make a very healthy improvement. The estimates on how much vary, but there's very little disagreement that by providing some increased aggregate demand and short-term stimulus, you don't solve the long-term problem, but at least you start to get people coming back to work.
Although Republican critics say that it would be at the cost of $200,000 per person who got a new job. Does that make any sense?
No, I don't think so. A lot of that is designed not only to create jobs in the short run, but to start building a more sustainable base for employment generation and growth in the long term. So I don't think that's a fair benefit-cost calculation.
Well, even if it did create that many jobs, wouldn't the unemployment rate still be around 8%?
Yes.
And today, the number of people applying for unemployment benefits, it was announced, fell slightly last week. The four-week average fell for the third straight week, but we're still talking about very high unemployment.
Yeah, and I think you're going to have high unemployment really for a long time, even if there was the stimulus that was suggested by President Obama and perhaps even a bigger stimulus that some of us would like to see. You know, fundamentally, the labor market here has changed over the last few years, and Michael has written a lot about this, but you know, basically America is not as competitive in the global labor market as it used to be. So the number of people who can be employed competitively in the world has gone down in America, and that means you're going to have a higher unemployment rate unless you tackle those long-term fundamental problems with the labor market.
Well, is this unique to the United States?
It isn't. I mean, if you look around Europe at the moment, it's not just a problem with the Eurozone having this sort of basket case currency. It's actually a problem that many Europeans are out of work. And one of the things that's been very striking about this particular downturn has been how much of the pain has been felt by young people under the age of 25, who are the people coming out of our education system into the labor market and finding there just isn't the work there for them.
Michael, you recently wrote that one of the jobs of political leadership when it really matters domestically and in the international domain is to understand the challenges, communicate the realities effectively, and design and sell solutions directly to the electorate when the political process is gridlocked. In the end, a good starting point is to tell the electorate the truth. Is anyone telling us the truth as you see it?
We're getting better at it. I think Matthew's recent comprehensive report in The Economist, you know, The Great Mismatch, is a very big step forward in telling the truth and painting it. But I think, you know,
but The Economist is read by a select group of people. We're not talking about the president going on television and telling this or members of Congress.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, my characterization would be we misdiagnosed the problem right after the crisis, let people believe that this was a big hit, but we'd have a fairly ordinary-looking recovery. Took us a year, year and a half, Matthew, to figure out that wasn't true, and there were some additional structural issues of the type that Matthew was just talking about. Now I think it's coming into focus, and there's a reasonable chance, maybe after the next election, that we'll have a real, you know, sit down with the American people and say, you know, we got a choice here. We can invest and make the opportunities for our children and grandchildren big, or we can do the opposite, and we have a choice now.
We've gotten calls from listeners who have wondered aloud why the president named Wall Street veterans as his economic advisors rather than some of the Nobel laureates we have, you, Paul Krugman, Joseph Stiglitz. There are some people who are a bit more conservative, but there are any number who might have gotten a little more respect.
I think it's one of the mysteries that President Obama's initial economics team seemed to represent so much continuity from the same bunch of people who brought the crisis about in the first place. And there were a lot of people there who he could have turned to. He made a lot of noise about seeking the advice of Paul Volcker, but then in practice largely ignored what Paul Volcker had to say. So it is a puzzle why he didn't get it. You know, he really relied on people who thought that this was a pretty regular downturn and going to be a pretty ordinary process of recovery, when all the evidence that we reported in The Economist, others have written about, said differently. It said this is a sort of long-term structural challenge to America's competitiveness in the world.
When he entered the White House in January 2009, the country's unemployment rate was about to climb above 8%, up from 5% a year before. Mm-hmm. It has not recovered. It's currently above 9%. Some states, 11%. But he might have argued, this is not my fault. This is something that was already in the works.
Well, there's a great deal of truth in that. You know, I think that it would have been easier to diagnose the problem if the influential Reinhard Rogoff book, This Time Is Different, had been published before, the crisis or immediately after. I think it would have been persuasively clear that there was a deleveraging balance sheet aspect of this, at least, that we had to deal with.
My guests are Michael Spence, who's a professor of economics at the Stern School of Business at NYU and a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, and also Matthew Matthew Bishop, the U.S. business editor for The Economist, which recently published its own jobs report. And Matthew, despite the high unemployment rate, you say that highly skilled workers are still scarce. How much of a jobs recovery depends on retraining existing workers?
Well, I think one of the most striking things as you go around the world looking at the jobs situation is that there are two very different labor markets. There's a labor market for people who have skills and talents that are in demand. And actually, demand for those people is stronger than probably it's ever been. And there's just an enormous opportunity for people. I mean, this is not just people in China and India. This is people here in America who have skills that people want, and they are getting great pay increases, great conditions. And then you have this other labor market, which unfortunately is growing in America and other rich countries like in Europe, which is of people who had expected their career to go down a fairly traditional path. They'd gone to high school, they'd gone to university, they'd got basic skills, and they thought they would have a job for life, and they're suddenly finding that job has disappeared, and what the work that is out there that's available for them is not attractive. It's on bad benefits, low pay, maybe part-time when they want to be full-time. So it's those two different worlds. And the question is, can we quickly reconnect those two worlds and bring more of the people that have lost competitiveness to have the skills that allow them to be in that more attractive labor market?
Haven't we been relying on people from other countries to fill those highly trained jobs?
Well, I mean,
is that affected by new immigration policies?
Well, it's ironically, one of the problems at the moment is that the sort of immigrants that actually would create jobs in America, because they're talented entrepreneurs and have skills that companies are looking for, they're being stopped from coming in by the way the visa rules are being applied. So, there are some immigrants that are arguably job takers, but there are many immigrants who are job creators, and the current impasse on immigration in Washington is stopping the very good immigrants coming in, as well as the ones that may be more of questionable value to America.
Michael, what kind of training would you recommend for the workforce?
Let me preface the answer, Leonard, by saying I think there are distributional implications of globalization that you can't completely overcome. We've had hundreds of millions of people enter the global economy, on the emerging market side. Having said that, you can upgrade the skills of people. You can make parts of the tradable side of the economy where we compete with other people, other countries, more competitive. You can expand it. It has not been an employment engine for the United States, net, for two decades.
This recovery has been called the jobless one.
Yes.
So what does that mean? Will the jobs that have been cut ever come back?
some of the jobs that disappeared, and it's not in the post-crisis period, but over a long period of time, are ones that actually belong in other parts of the global economy. They're labor-intensive, lower value-added. And what happened in the American economy is those jobs, which tend to be held by the lower to mid dimension of our income distribution educational spectrum, went abroad, and those folks in our economy found employment in the non-tradable side, in government, healthcare, construction, you know, and so on. And that came to a sudden stop. So we've got a jobless recovery because the employment engines that were running before the crisis aren't running right now.
And you write that between 1990 and 2008, 98% of the 27 million net new jobs created in America were in the non-tradable sector of the economy.
That's right.
That's an incredible amount. So we've changed. We no longer are a manufacturing country. But for a long time, we used to pride ourselves in being the great innovator. And, okay, so then the things that we invented were then being manufactured in other countries. But it's my sense that that has slowed down as well. A lot of the innovation has come from elsewhere.
Well, this is, again, one of the surprises is that, you know, we all think of America, as you say, as one of, as the great entrepreneurial country of the world. And actually, there's been a sharp decline in the amount of entrepreneurship.
Do we have any sense of why?
I think partly it's the lack of bank credit, a lack of basic finance available to people to start up businesses and grow them. Partly it's the fact that, you know, normally you need to have growth in the economy to provide a sense of belief that if you do create a new business, it's going to have a marketplace. And I think there's the same as big business is currently affected by a pessimism about where the economy is going. I think the same is true about some entrepreneurs. And so those firms that are being started, many of those are actually people who lost their job, say, in a big construction firm and are just starting up their own small little building firm where it's maybe one or two people working. And that's very different from the entrepreneurial model that we have in mind of the sort of Silicon Valley garage, you know, which is growing into a huge company. And now that some of those companies are being grown, you know, like Groupon or Facebook, but there's just far fewer of them than we've seen over the previous 20 years.
It's less likely to see a new Steve Jobs today. But this non-tradable sector growth, is this a result of globalization? Is it happening in all developed countries?
Yes, to some extent. These are powerful, I would call them technological and global economic forces, and I've looked at a number of them, including Germany. And while the tradable sector remained employment engine in Germany because they worked hard at it, you see the same patterns, the lower value-added manufacturing decline. Let me just add, Leonard, you know, to reinforce something Matthew said before, there's a part of the tradable sector that we associate with consulting, designing computers, running multinational enterprise, finance, where these are service industries in some sense or parts of them. They're very healthy. We're very good at it. That's partly where the innovation occurs. They generate jobs and growth and all that kind of stuff. So we don't want to paint too bleak a picture, even now. That's the part of our economy that's growing.
Well, you also say in developed economies that are currently struggling, many people, perhaps more than ever, are doing the job of their dreams, taking home both a good salary and a sense of having done something worthwhile. In booming emerging countries such as China and India, many at least have a better job than they ever thought possible. Yet, at the same time, in much of the world, unemployment is persistently high, and many of the jobs on offer are badly paid, onerous, and unsatisfying. So this sounds like an insoluble situation.
It's not insoluble, but it's going to take time to solve it. You know, what is an attractive job? It really depends on where you live. If you were living near the poverty line in India and China 20 years ago, having a job where you're learning how to be a middle manager, you know, in an industry that you may or may not find attractive is a huge step up. It's not necessarily perceived the same way in Europe and America, where we live.
I mean, there are two ways I think you could make a difference quite fast. I mean, one is that currently there's very little communication between community colleges, universities, high schools, you know, with the business world to actually ask, you know, what skills should we be producing? What talents do people need? And in particular, how do you make people employable in the sense of work ready, ready to go into an office and immediately sort of understand what modern work involves. And the second thing is, you know, I think there is a real case for looking at youth unemployment as differently and saying when people first come into the labour market, it's so important that they get a job that we don't lose them forever, because once you become disconnected that early in your life from labour, you may never work again.
Well, in China, we have seen a situation where people from the middle of the country have all moved to the coast to get jobs. It's been very disruptive to the culture, although it's led to an economic boom. Americans used to be much more mobile than they are today. They're less likely to want to move where the jobs are.
The housing situation, you know, with at least 40, probably more, mortgages exceeding the value has dramatically reduced the mobility of people. You know, you just can't abandon your house. So that may not be the only factor, but those two things are negatively interacting.
My guests are Michael Spence, who won the Nobel Prize in Economic Sciences in 2001. He is a professor of economics at the Stern School of Business at NYU, and his latest book is called The Next Convergence, The Future of Economic Growth in a Multi-Speed World. Also with us is Matthew Bishop, the Economist, U.S. business correspondent and New York bureau chief. And The Economist just recently published a jobs report, which we are also discussing. Stay with us for more. First, this. We're back with Nobel laureate Michael Spence and Matthew Bishop, The Economist U.S. Bureau correspondent, the business correspondent and New York Bureau chief. And we're talking about the current situation with employment and related matters. With most of the developed countries already running high deficits and increasing concern about them, what policy tools are actually available to governments?
Well, I think this is a huge problem. That because governments got themselves into bad habits before the crash happened, they have really constrained their ability to actually do what should be done in a down economy. So we haven't been able to get the kind of stimulus that's needed. And we at The Economist have argued that The administration needs to do two things at once. It needs to provide a credible long-term plan for getting America's deficit under control. And if it can come up with that, which looks pretty difficult in Washington at the moment, then it can probably get away with the kind of short-term stimulus that's needed now. But if it doesn't address the long-term issues simultaneously, it's going to run up against the kind of problems it's running up at the moment, where simply additional deficit just makes people panic and think, gosh, you know, things are getting out of control.
Well, those bad habits seem to be contagious. They're all over the world. Were there any countries that were not getting into bad habits?
Yes. I mean, some of the Holland, Denmark, some of the northern countries, Germany, have been on a different path.
Although Germany right now is going through its own issues and
a certain amount
of labor strife.
No, this isn't, you know, sort of free of strife, and it's not free of problems. But what the Germans did do in starting around 2000, 2001 is identify a huge competitiveness and productivity problem of the type that you see all over Europe. And they went after it, you know, labor market flexibility, muted wage and income growth, commitment to employment, you know, involving the unions, government and business together. And by and large, I think that set them up pretty well.
In similar situations in the past, John Maynard Keynes always seemed to be called to the rescue, and that includes in this country both Democratic and Republican administrations. Mm-hmm. Richard Nixon seemed to be a very strong Keynesian, for example. Today, John Maynard Keynes's name seems to almost be everybody seems to hate him, and nobody seems to want to go back to his approach.
I mean, the sadness is that, you know, Keynes's ideas are really at their best, it seems to me, in crises moments like this. They're not so useful in terms of justifying big government, which is how they're often used. I think Keynes would have been a real critic of the kind of big government spending programs that existed before the crisis, but he would have been fiercely advocating for a much larger stimulus to get out of the crisis, because that's when you need the government to intervene. And unfortunately, by following bad policies before the crisis, governments have just limited themselves so they can't do what Keynes would actually do. And of course, for old Keynes from the grave is getting a terrible rap.
Because he's being blamed for things that
he wouldn't have supported.
How much of a role do tax rates play in helping a recovery? Warren Buffett has urged Congress to raise taxes on millionaires and close some of the loopholes. How much revenue would that actually bring in?
Well, you know, you could fund some important investments that we probably ought to make. Taxes are a double-edged sword. You know, I think probably going in the direction of taxing investment and labor income at a lower rate and taxing consumption, you know, is a sensible direction to go. You can justify using stimulus, you know, some lower tax rates that aren't on a sustainable fiscal path.
Which Keynes also believed in.
He would have believed in. But I think the issue that's missing in the discussion, Leonard, is the notion that, you know, is what happened in World War II. You know, in World War II, we had an emergency that wasn't economic, and the government went to the people and said, you know, we're going to have to, you know, really tighten our belts. We're going to invest in the war effort and a whole bunch of other things, and people said yes. Nobody has gone to the American people and said the same thing in this context, and maybe couldn't politically.
Maybe we need a World War III.
Well, that's not a bit of a draconian answer.
But I mean, I think you make a very interesting point about Germany, though.
They've been making cuts in the public sector.
The contrast between Germany and America over the past 10 years, where Germany, I think, did face up to its competitiveness challenge, and America actually decided to try and borrow and maintain a lifestyle that it really couldn't afford. And so it was in denial for 7 or 8 years about how severe the problem was. And many of the jobs that were created in the first decade of this century were in fueling that unsustainable spending boom. And so those jobs have gone away because the spending boom has gone away. And now you're left with a crisis that should have been addressed at least a decade ago, that we're going to take many years to catch up with the likes of Germany.
My guests are Matthew Bishop, the Economist U.S. business correspondent and New York bureau chief, and Nobel laureate Michael Spence. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Many countries have made cuts in the public sector, including cutting jobs. Does that cure the problem or compound the problem?
In the short run, I don't know if Matthew agrees, it compounds the problem. You know, what we want to do is not have our state and local governments consolidating so fast, but the only way in our system to do it is to have the federal government help finance some of this.
Well, I'm from Britain, where the new government there that was elected in 2010 has come in with a very aggressive austerity agenda, which is going to involve reducing government's share of the economy by about 7 percentage points over a 5-year period, which is a very, very dramatic squeeze on public spending. And, you know, it's going to be really interesting to watch whether that is going to result in Britain coming more quickly out of the crisis of jobs, or whether it's going to actually prolong it. And because I think people are really uncertain about that, because it certainly benefited Britain to say we're getting our public finances in order, we're not Greece, we're not Ireland, we're not Spain, and so they've been getting much better rates when they've been raising money in the international capital markets. On the other hand, you know, they are going to be firing a lot of people from government jobs, and it's not clear there are other jobs for them to move into.
And David Cameron's spending cuts have been pretty unpopular.
They have, and you know, I think he's still more popular than I think there's no sense that the Labour Party opposition is really going to come up with an agenda that is more convincing than what the government's pursuing in Britain at the moment.
Well, in the past, what seemed to happen in England was Labour would come to power, they would nationalise a whole bunch of things. The Tories would come to power, they would denationalise some of those things, so keep a few nationalised. Then Labour would come back and renationalise. And that process ended with Tony Blair, didn't it?
Yeah, and I think what's interesting in Britain, again, which America might learn from, is that the debate in between the two parties in Britain now is about how do you intervene in the labour market to get people back to work. And so Labour had this scheme which was basically to say anybody under the age of 24 that was out of work for a year was guaranteed either a job or a place in a training scheme. The Cameron came in and immediately scrapped that scheme. And they have a scheme where they've recruited a whole load of private companies and said, if you can get someone who's unemployed for more than a year into a job that they keep for a year, then we're going to pay you a lot of money as a private company because you've solved that problem for us. So there's two different philosophical differences, but fundamentally it's about active intervention in the labour market. And America is very, very bad about that as well. The amount of money that the American government spends on trying to get the unemployed back to work is very low compared to international standards.
the labor in this country is also upset about something that happened in Congress yesterday when Congress approved three free trade agreements that have been held up for 5 years. They had actually been held up before the financial meltdown started. Do free trade agreements make any sense today? Can they help create jobs, as the politicians promise they will?
They do make sense. I mean, you know, we benefit, and lots of other people benefit from the open global economy that American leadership created in the post-war period. But it has its costs. I think American labor is on the wrong side of that issue.
Well, but they saw a lot of jobs lost after NAFTA was created.
Yeah, this is really a question of what instruments do you use to fix the problem. You know, you can use income distribution, you can use skills training, or you can use protectionism, you know, and protect the markets and the jobs.
And that's what we've done with China just the other day, isn't it?
Well, we're moving in that direction. Now, I guess the charitable interpretation of that is that we're trying to get China to change a certain aspect of its behavior, namely the rate of appreciation of its currency, and not really trying to start a war with them on the economic front, but we'll see.
In August, you were interviewed on Bloomberg News, and you put a double-dip recession at 50-50. Since then, the economic outlook in America and Europe hasn't improved. So where do you stand today on that?
About the same. I mean, I think, you know, the risk of a double-dip recession here mainly comes from Europe. We're by far each other's largest trading partners. If Europe takes a nosedive, which I think there's some risk of, that'll take us down. And so that's the logic behind that wild guess.
The policy challenges in Europe to create both fiscal stabilization and growth seem daunting. It seems that the Eurozone is going to have to impose more regulations on sovereign nations in the zone, and that won't be easy. Are the austerity measures being imposed now in Greece, Ireland, Portugal, and Spain good for any of those economies in the long run?
Well, I think the interesting thing about Europe is that it's basically going through a phase of evolution where it's debating what is the future of the European Union going to look like. So you can't just judge what's going on by sort of the underlying economics. It's much more about politics, about is Europe going to become a super state that's more like America than a group of separate countries together? Because the euro currency, when it was launched, I think most experts would have said this is going to have a political crisis when it comes up, because you can't have a currency that brings together such very different economies as Greece and Germany without having some kind of political system underpinning it that means that when the currency exchange rate is bad for the weak economy and good for the strong economy, that the money is transferred to help the weak economy cope with the economic situation globally. And so we're going to find out what kind of political system Europe wants to have for the next 50 years, 100 years.
But there's still benefits to having the euro. That is, it cuts down on all sorts of expenses.
Well, that's my bet. My bet would be ultimately that we will see the euro survive and that they will manage their way out of the crisis. The trouble is that at the moment you've got to bring 17 sovereign governments within the eurozone to the table to sign off on everything, and each of them is trying to play games with everybody else to try and get the best possible deal for themselves. And right. So it's just going to be a long and kind of, it will feel like one crisis after another, but I think the end game may actually be that Europe emerges as more of a federal state, more like the United States than it was going into the crisis.
You said that Germany has handled this better than some. Many commentators have pointed to Germany's policy of cutting back on workers' hours across the board so that layoffs can be avoided. Is that a strategy that could be successful in this country?
Yes, it is. I mean, it's not confined to Germany. The Dutch did the same thing. Number of emerging economies did the same thing. This is a way of treating, you know, your employees as a form of capital, and you want to keep them. They have embedded skills that are valuable to you, and so you basically sort of spread the work around, cut back hours and so on. And I don't think it's necessarily right in all circumstances, but it's turned out to be a pretty effective response.
Well, in late July, didn't thousands of unemployed young Spaniards known as Los Indignados, the indignant, begin a long march to Brussels to draw attention to the shockingly high jobless rate of over 40% among their age group? It's affecting young people in this country as well.
Well, I think you only need to go down to Wall Street and see the Occupy Wall Street protests and see that this is a global phenomenon. Mm-hmm. I think it is very, very striking that the real pain of this economic downturn has been felt more by younger people than any previous downturn that we've had since the Second World War. And it shocks me that that youth element, and how do we make sure that young people don't become permanently disconnected from the world of work, that hasn't been a higher political priority. And so while I think the Occupy Wall Street protests seem a bit nebulous to me, it's not clear exactly what they're actually asking for, I think it is a long overdue cry for help and a cry
for
attention.
Maybe that's what they're asking for.
Yes, I hope so.
Absolutely.
Michael, since you said that good leadership requires being straightforward with the electorate, shouldn't the leaders of the Eurozone be honest and begin a controlled default by Greece?
I think so. I mean, either that or bail them out completely. Greece is only 2%, and it's actually affordable to bail them out. The problem that nobody has an answer to, is Greece is estimated to be about 40% out of bounds in terms of productivity, with, you know, in order to compete in the tradable side of the global economy. And if you don't have the exchange rate and you don't have inflation, it's very hard to know, you know, even if magically their fiscal situation were stabilized overnight, you know, how they're going to generate jobs and grow.
In your book, you note that the world has changed at lightning speed in your own lifetime, but they are about to speed up even more. How do we prepare for so many unknowns?
Well, that's very hard. I mean, I think that's a question to which I frankly think the honest answer is, certainly for me, is we don't know. We're entering uncharted territory to some extent. We're going to have to be pragmatic and navigate and do the best we can, but we don't have a template that tells us everything we need to do.
I mean, I think there is clearly a message, which is you should be learning science, technology, English language, engineering, skills, because they're much more likely to be in demand going forward. And also, you should learn to be flexible and be able to really figure out how to work in a modern workplace. And a lot of people leaving high school, leaving college, they just don't have the right manner in terms of going into an office and actually being able to immediately fit in. And so if you can acquire those skills, whatever happens to demand for jobs, I think you're going to have a decent opportunity. Whereas if you don't have those skills, it's going to be much, much harder.
A listener in Brooklyn asks about the current patent law and whether updating it could help market outlook and investment.
Yes. Updating the patent law, I think, would be on a fairly long list of really useful reforms.
What are some of the others you would recommend?
Some of the things Matthew talked about, you know, on the community college skills and training level, I think we desperately need tax reform. There's various opinions about what it should end up looking like, but nobody thinks the current system is in place. We could use a sensible energy policy that anticipates rising relative prices of oil and other natural resources as the enormous growth in demand comes from the emerging markets and so on and so on. Not all these things cost money. These are just, you know, thinking ahead and trying to figure out ways to get our economy and all of our people ready for an evolving future.
Michael Spence won the 2001 Nobel Prize in Economic Sciences. He's a professor of economics at the Stern School of Business at NYU, a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, and a former chair of the Independent Commission on Growth and Development. His latest book is called The Next Convergence, The Future of Economic Growth in a Multi-Speed World. Matthew Bishop is the Economist U.S. business correspondent and its New York bureau chief, and his newspaper has just recently published a jobs report that is eye-opening, and I want to thank both of you for being on our show today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.